Every work team has moments of conflict and dysfunction. Sometimes productive conflict is a necessary part of wrestling through big ideas to get to the best possible outcome. But sometimes our teams become mired in conflict that is entirely avoidable because it's based in vastly different communication styles or different motivations and misunderstandings. Enter the Enneagram. The Enneagram offers not only self-awareness, but also curiosity and deeper understanding of others. I teach the Enneagram and consult with teams to improve their communication styles, conflict effectiveness, and self-leadership, all of which foster highly engaged and high-performing teams. During a recent team event, I heard over and over, this just makes so much sense when they looked around the room and saw who was fitting within each type. And now I know why this person asked so many questions, or this depersonalizes some of the conflict we've been having because I can tell we're just coming from different perspectives. So now that we know where we are, we can see how we can get aligned. So if you're looking for ongoing support or simply considering an engaging introspective module for your team's offsite or event, let's talk. Reach out to the Nine Types team at hello@ninetypes.co or schedule a one-on-one consultation with me on my website, ninetypes.co. And now, on to the show.
By getting better at asking questions and finding a way to focus my attention through questions, I was not only sort of stoking my curiosity and activating my brain, but I was like infusing creativity into my mind, into my life. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I feel like anybody can do it. Anybody can get better at asking questions. And you can even bring this to social settings, like, you know, and connect more with people, because when you start to become curious about somebody, that's when I think the real deep connections kind of open up.
Hello, and welcome back to Enneagram in Real Life, a podcast where we explore how to apply our Enneagram knowledge in our daily lives. I'm your host, Steph Baron Hall, and on today's episode, I have a really interesting conversation coming for you. So today I'm actually talking with a bio-inspirationalist, and our guest today will actually share a little bit more about what that means, but basically taking some inspiration from nature to apply that to solving problems in the real world. And in particular, this guest is a biomedical engineering professor and inventor, and the author of a brand new book that is out today. I already have it selected on my library app, so I'm really excited to check it out, and I hope you are as well. But throughout this episode, we talk with Dr. Jeff Karp, and he talks a little bit about being a kid with ADHD, and his Enneagram type, which is type 7, and a little bit about having kind of that maximalist type 7 attitude and applying the concepts of radical simplicity to his approach to his work. He told a story on his TED Talk, which I can link below, about some of the ways that he approached things early in his career and how he changed his approach to be more simple and actually a lot more successful in developing solutions for everyday problems. So we talked a little bit about what inspired his book, which is called Lit: Life Ignition Tools, what he means by low brain energy state versus high brain energy state, how doing new things can actually help us get into that high brain energy state, a four-step process to bring more awareness to ourselves and to our thoughts, connecting to our senses to help us get out of our heads, which I know for a lot of head types, that's really useful. But even for me, that's helpful as well. I'm a heart type as an Enneagram 3, but I have a really difficult time sometimes connecting more to my body. It's a lot easier for me to connect to the head center. So I find that this is helpful for me too. And then we talked about creativity and curiosity and how small changes throughout our day-to-day life can create more momentum. I think one thing I appreciate about sevens is when they feel like life is stagnant or they don't really enjoy or appreciate what they're doing in the day-to-day, they say, well, okay, I'm going to change this. If I can't change it, I will accept it. But first, I'm going to try to change it. So I really appreciate that about sevens. And Dr. Karp offers us some of that in this conversation today as well. So I don't want to keep you too long here. I want to jump right into the interview. And like I said, this is such a fascinating and interesting interview. I have never interviewed a guest that was a biomedical engineer, and just such a cool job and so many fresh and interesting perspectives that he offers and brings to not only this conversation, but also his book, which I'm really excited to pick up. So, Dr. Jeff Karp is an acclaimed mentor and biomedical engineering professor at Harvard Medical School and MIT. As a child, his teacher wanted to hold him back in the second grade, and as an adult, he got his PhD, became a celebrated professor and member of the National Academy of Inventors, and a distinguished chair at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he has co-founded 12 companies, amassed over 100 patents, and received 50 awards. Fueled by his life ignition tools, which he calls LIT, L-I-T, Jeff turned to nature for inspiration to revolutionize lab practices. Now, Jeff is sharing his lessons in his debut book. LIT aims to empower others to take themselves off autopilot and unlock their own reservoirs of potential. So grab a copy of the book in the show notes, and I really hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to learn more about Dr. Jeff Karp, you can find his website at jeffkarp.com. That's K-A-R-P.com. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Jeff Karp. Well, Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you. And I know a little bit about your work just because I did some Googling. And I also watched your TEDx talk, which I thought was really helpful about radical simplicity and using failure as kind of a jumping off point, which I really appreciated. And so I'd love to hear a little bit more about your background and where you come from.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, whenever I get that question, I'm trying to figure out, okay, where do I start? Right. Because there's so many possibilities. And talking about failure, I would say, you know, there's just been so much of it in my life and so many struggles. I mean, we could go back and start in grade two if you want. We could start in my undergrad and my grad. I mean, there's just so many different ways to start. Maybe where a good place like to begin is actually in grade two, because that's where my life really took a massive turn. So I had undiagnosed ADHD and learning differences. I didn't know it. My parents didn't know it. My teachers certainly didn't know it. And I was just struggling so much because of it. I couldn't sound out words. I wasn't learning anything. I was sitting at the back, frustrated, angry, kind of demoralized, like really not connecting with anyone either. At the end of the year, the teacher sort of pulled my parents aside and said that he would like to hold me back a year and repeat the second grade. And my parents negotiated that if I spent the summer with special tutors and things, that I could go on to the third grade. So all my friends went on vacation, and I spent the entire summer with tutors. And what happened was, one day I went in, and I'll never forget, it was just such a transformational thing that happened, because we were like reading this passage and they asked me some questions. And then they said, "How did you think about that?" And no one had ever asked me that before. And I was just kind of, it was literally like one of these like light bulb moments that I was like, wait a moment, I can think about how I think. I feel like I was like an impulsive child, just said what was ever on my mind, just did sort of like acted impulsively and things. And it was like this portal or this canvas sort of opened, and I could now, before I spoke, it was like this awareness. I had all of a sudden this awareness of my thoughts that I never had before. And I started to bring that to all kinds of things in my life. Just one example, I started to notice, like, you know, here's this super distracted kid, pretty extreme on the spectrum. And I noticed anytime I asked a question, that my attention would be like hyper-focused for a few moments, and that I could actually learn something and retain something, and that it wouldn't just be in my working memory, but it could go into my long-term memory. And I could start connecting dots between what I already knew. And I, you know, so it was like, and that totally lit up my brain. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really interesting, because I need to ask a lot of questions. Like, that is a tool for me to survive. And so that's really where things began and where a lot of the tools that I've been developing, and I didn't get identified. Actually, one other thing I'll say is I didn't get identified. The school didn't want to identify me, because they just were under-resourced and didn't know too much about it. But my mom, like, who's a massive supporter, went up against the school board in the seventh grade, prepared a massive file on everything, all the things teachers said about me. Like, you know, they were calling me like lazy and a lost cause and just, you know, like all kinds of nasty things. But she went to the school board and actually pushed for them to identify me as having learning differences. And I got diagnosed with ADHD, and my grades went from C's and D's to A's. The struggles did not stop. It was still like, you know, I was always like kind of working and exhausted, but I just like, that was such a liberating moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so helpful. Like, I really like that story too, because I was diagnosed with ADHD at the end of grad school. And I was like, oh my God, things would have been so much easier if I had known this all along, you know? It's eye-opening.
It actually, like, I don't know, there's just something about it. I feel it's, you know, it's a personal thing, but there's something about having that diagnosis and being able to sort of rationalize, you know, I don't know, for me, like how my mind works and stuff. And then even my wife, so during COVID, she attended some sessions, like group sessions for partners of people who have ADHD. Mm-hmm. And it was like for her, it was like a jaw-dropping experience because everybody was talking about the same thing. Yeah. And it was almost like, I feel like she felt maybe at times that the things I would say or the things I would do, I was intentionally doing it, you know, maybe to upset her. But like, mm-hmm. she kind of heard like everybody, it was like, that's just how it is. And I mean, I've been trying to develop tools to overcome these challenges and sort of deal with it, but it's still like, you know, every day is a bit of a struggle, I would say. But for her, it was just so kind of earth shattering for her to hear that what she was experiencing is exactly the same as what other partners of people who have ADHD experience on a daily basis.
Yeah. Got to get my husband on that, that group call. Every time I leave all the cabinets open in the kitchen.
Yeah. I mean, I leave things out all the time as well, because it's like, if I don't see it, then I don't think about it. So I kind of strategically leave things everywhere. And then, but my wife is like super clean and tidy and like everything's super organized, which is amazing. But then I forget a lot of things because then I don't see them, you know,
like that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Like no object permanence.
Yes.
That's so funny. Well, okay, so let's talk a little bit about your Enneagram type, because I think even as people are already listening to this conversation so far, they might already have a guess. So I'm curious if you want to share a little bit about your type and just discovering the Enneagram.
Yeah. So I'm a 7, an enthusiast, and I feel like it pretty much fits me to a T. I'll just give you an example, like in my laboratory. So I run a research lab, at Harvard Medical School at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And my lab is focused on the process of medical problem solving and bringing that to many different problems. And so we don't really have a focus other than the process. And so we've been working on, you know, treatments for arthritis and cancer and inflammatory bowel disease and developing needles and implants and diagnostic devices. And it's like all over the place. In fact, at one point, the chair of my department came to me and said like, hey, no one's going to understand what you're doing unless you focus. And I tried to take that advice seriously, but I realized, you know, sevens can't really follow that advice because it's like, you know, it's like in the DNA, right? Like the programming, the wiring to really just constantly be interested in new experiences and experimenting. And so I just learned that that really is part of my, that's what I'm passionate about, is just constantly getting into new areas, experimenting with new things. And even with my routines and let's say rituals in life, I'm sort of the mindset that, I never like to keep anything, even if it's going really well for a long period of time, because I always feel like there's something else I want to try. So I like purposely sort of break up the, you know, it's like break up the rituals so that maybe there's an opening to something else might come in that I never tried before that would be exciting to do.
Yeah. Well, and I think that makes a lot of sense, especially with sevens, like wanting this constant mental stimulation. And, you know, the passion of type seven being gluttony in the sense of like wanting to just take all of these ideas, sample everything, try a little bit of everything. But you have this tool that you talked about in your TEDx talk, which is radical simplicity, that helps you focus a little bit more. And can you share a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So that actually I learned through a fairly painful experience. If we go back, let's say to 2008, I had just started my laboratory in 2007. And, it was towards the end of 2008. And we had developed a technology that I was just super excited about. I mean, we were on the cusp of something what I thought was huge, which was we'd figured out how to take stem cells out of the body and program them so that you could infuse them back into the body through the bloodstream and have them go to different sites in the body, like on demand, like almost like a GPS for your car. We figured out a way to do that with stem cells. So for example, you could potentially use it to target the bone to treat osteoporosis, or to the heart to prevent progression from heart attack into heart failure, or to the brain to treat neurological conditions. And we had data showing, like preliminary data suggesting that we could do this. And so I went to an investor in town, Flagship Ventures. I met with the founder. And, so excited. I couldn't sleep the night before. I go in, I'm like, a little bit nervous, but I'm really excited. And I go through the data and I'm kind of like have this smirk on my face. And I'm like, we got this in the bag. Like this is for sure company materials. And he leaned over Newbar, the head of Flagship Ventures. He leaned in and he goes, this is really exciting, but we're not going to do it. And I was like, what? And he goes, it's just too complicated. And I didn't really hear him say those words per se, because when he said, we're not going to do it, I was like so shocked. It was like the first major project in my laboratory, that I just like poured my heart into. I was so excited about it. And so I went back to my lab and I kind of knew, like through encountering so many struggles and failures and challenges along the way, that emotions associated with these things tend to dissipate after a day or two or three, just get a good night's sleep. And then that's when this window opens where I feel like I've gained the greatest insights in my life, like after a failure, once the emotions start to subside, when it start to be kind of like, I'd be a little bit curious about what just happened and sort of connecting things in different ways. And I was like, wait a moment. There's a question that we failed to ask, which is what happens after we develop a technology in the lab, like how does it get to patients? We just developed the technology. We didn't even think of the steps afterwards, like going to a clinical trial or the manufacturing complexity, like all these different things. And I was like, we need to change things. So that's where this concept of radical simplicity was born, which is, I think of it as the art and discipline of minimizing complexity at all levels. So it's like complexity only when needed. And so, for every project moving forward in my lab, radical simplicity was at the heart of it. And also, I never forgot that question, what happens next? And so I ended up doing all sorts of things to maximize the potential that everything we worked on in the lab, could get to patients as quickly as possible. So, and there are all kinds of things I did, which I'm happy to talk about, but that concept of radical simplicity has just been so critical to everything that we do.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that it would take a lot of, mental energy to be able to harness that, because it's like almost more mental energy than it would take to just be curious and like jumping all over the place all the time.
Yeah. There's some sort of, really magical focus that, or this window into a focused state that I think you can step forward into after a failure. It's kind of like after the rain, like it's just, there's something there that you can sort of feel. And, it's like, These sort of like windows that have opened after these challenging times have just been crucible moments in my life. And in some ways, I've almost sought them out. One other thing I just really want to emphasize in all of this is my mom's support. And I think this is so important because I feel like just like children need a lot more support than we think they need. And I got that support from my mom. And I think that was one of the reasons why in my life, I've been able to have courage to take risks and fairly big risks, even though I've encountered major like catastrophes and disasters kind of along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Got a shout out to moms, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, just thinking about the ADHD thing as well. Like my mom would put me on like a mini trampoline to help me like stay moving while I was learning things.
Oh, wow.
And that was so helpful. And we didn't know I had ADHD, but she's like, this little girl cannot focus. Like, so
is that with the handle where it's just like a trampoline and there was like a little handle in front of it and you could, or
we didn't have the handle. I don't think that they really cared as much about the safety portion back then.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. Okay. I want to pivot a little bit and talk about your book, which is called Lit: Life Ignition Tools. And the subtitle is Use Nature's Playbook to Energize Your Brain, Spark Ideas, and Ignite Action. Tell me a little bit about your book and how it came to be.
Sure. So Lit is really all about, you know, just it's the concept. I think the big idea is really simple. It's taking yourself off autopilot to live to your full potential. And it's this sense that, you know, we're just inundated these days with information and stimuli coming at us from all directions. And I think it's just more challenging than ever to be intentional in our lives, to make deliberate decisions and to act deliberately and even think deliberately. And so Lit is a set of 12 simple holistic tools that can help us tap into this incredible energy that we all have within, and activate this heightened state of awareness that we can bring to any situation, to deepen our everyday experiences and really build intentionality into everything. And it kind of came to be because, and my wife actually reminded me of this, that when she met me, back in the year 2000, I used to carry around all these notebooks, and it wasn't like I was doing like serious journaling, but I would just write down my thoughts. And I said to her apparently at one point that I was going to write a book one day. And so what happened was, like 7 years ago or so, an agent from New York reached out because we do a lot of work in my lab, in bioinspiration. So turning to nature for inspiration for new ideas. And, you know, we've looked at like how geckos walk on surfaces and hang from a single toe, and there's no chemistry there. It's all kind of physical geometry interactions. It's really interesting. And we've looked at slugs and snails and sandcastle worms and porcupine quills and spider webs and jellyfish and, you know, all kinds of different things. We're looking at a lot of creatures in the ocean now. But there was an article in Fortune magazine on some of the work that we had done. And so Heather Jackson from New York reached out and said, hey, how would you like to write a book on bioinspiration? And I thought about it and I was like, you know, actually, that sounds pretty interesting. But what I'm feeling more, what's really transmitting, you know, kind of more for me is to write a book about all of these tools and strategies that I've been developing in my life through all the struggles with learning differences and ADHD. And that's what I really want to share. I don't know. I've always had this sort of inner desire to share, like sort of to figure out processes that work for me and then to share it with others. And so when I do my scientific presentations, I don't show that much data. I actually talk mostly about the processes that I use to figure things out. And so this book to me was really, how can I just share with the world all of these processes and tools that I have used to kind of get back up from the struggles and the challenges that I faced and to really just thrive in life in every possible way.
Wow. That's so cool to think about solving things as nature does, because obviously we can learn a lot from nature in general. But wow. Okay. I don't have like a coherent question.
Yeah. I mean, I could say one more thing about it if you want. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, the way I like to think about nature, and there's so many ways that I think about nature. So, but I'll just talk about one here is, like evolution is the best problem solver, right? So like anything that's alive today, you know, plants or animals, has overcome insurmountable challenges to be here. Like there's all sorts of changes that have happened in the environment, and these creatures have adapted to survive. And so we're literally surrounded by solutions. And so these can be ideas that we can learn from, gain insights from, to help solve problems. And there's so many examples, like even like, you know, examples people might be able to connect with, like in Japan, the high-speed train, they were going through these tunnels and it was breaking the sound barrier and creating these loud noises. And so they changed the shape of the front of the train to mimic the kingfisher bird, which like basically dive bombs into the water to get its prey. And so they did that so it would prevent these loud booms, you know, from coming out of the tunnel. And there's just so many examples. There's like a beetle in the desert that can collect water on its back, like through like the moisture in the morning. And it has these little micro channels that it like directs it to its mouth. And so people are now using that to collect fog in, you know, very dry places to then, you know, collect water.
That's so cool. So fascinating.
Yeah, nature's like just so, I mean, there's so many facets of nature. And I think, you know, we're kind of also getting to this point where the science is becoming more and more developed and understood about how, when we go out into nature, how it can switch, help us switch from like the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system, and really lower our heart rate and our blood pressure, and can give us a greater sense of well-being and develop an interconnected mindset. And so, and it's all there, right? It's like right there. Even watching a show, like if you just put on like a nature scene, like on YouTube, for example, that's been demonstrated to have an effect as well. It's not exactly the same magnitude as if you're out in nature, you know, having that experiential time, but just watching nature has been demonstrated to help people like just have this sense of wellness and sort of calming sense. And so I've been experimenting with all kinds of things in nature recently.
Oh, so cool. Yeah, I think one of the things that's related to that you mention in your book is about the high energy state, or the brain in like a high energy brain state versus low energy state. And I'm curious if you can share a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So this is kind of just how I kind of think of this, how I have experienced it. And so what I've noticed is that my brain gravitates towards this low energy brain, where it kind of anticipates what comes next. It's like this autopilot mode. You could even call it like the low energy state, I'll give you an example. Like, let's say, you're on your cell phone and it tells you you need to update your password. And so you update your password, but then the next time you enter the old password. So that's like the autopilot. Or sometimes, let's say if you're driving your car and you get to the destination, you completely forget the route that you took. That's like this low energy brain state. Or if you get to the end of a meal and you're shocked that it's done, you can't even remember a single flavor that you've experienced. Or if you're walking around your neighborhood and, you know, you're just sort of like lost in your mind and you're not really experiencing anything with your senses, like that's kind of an autopilot mode. Or when you're reading and you read a page or a paragraph and just nothing has sunk in your mind to someone, like that's autopilot. And so that's like the low energy brain state. And so to me, there's all kinds of things we can do to activate our brains. And this has been essential in my laboratory because we're working on some really hard problems. And so I think, you know, one way is turning to nature for inspiration is a way to bring in fresh ideas and fresh energy into projects. So, you know, literally like just going and looking in the literature on what people know about how ivy's able to walk, like to basically, you know, crawl up buildings and put their little root hairs in and shrivel up and mechanically interlock. Like it just is this like fascinating, like activates our curiosity, activates our brains. And so there's so many things we can do to get our brains into a high energy state. And that's where we do our best learning. That's where we sort of make the best decisions. That's where we do our best thinking. And so in the book, you know, I talk a lot about all the different tools that we can use to get our brains into this high energy state so that we can really, you know, maximize like connections with people and bring deep meaning to our lives and really maximize innovation in the workplace, for example.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of one of those tactics?
Sure. So I'll give you, an example. There's so many examples. So when I'm asked for an example, I'm like, okay, which one do I pick? But you know, one thing, for example, one of the tools is Do New. And it's about because I think what happens is that as humans, we kind of gravitate towards, you know, the low energy state is also kind of, it's like habituation, right? Like we kind of get used to something and our neurons, our receptors, you know, the neurons stop firing at the same magnitude as they did when we were learning something. And so it kind of settles in and we get kind of this dulling effect. And so anytime we do something new in our lives, it really just like our brains love it. It just like our brains literally glow orange on an MRI when we're engaged in new activities, when we're kind of, and so, you know, one example is like, you know, when I was in high school and I was just, you know, struggling a lot with with my learning differences in ADHD. And even though I had been identified and diagnosed, it was still like, you know, I was meeting with teachers after school every day. On the weekends I was going in. And there was this track and field day and, I was not athletic. Like I was the kid who like only got on base for baseball when I got walked or when I was hit with the ball. I was just never athletic, but a track and field day, for some reason, I just felt gravity towards discus. There was like, you know, and so I wasn't very good at it. But I bought a discus and, you know, arrived at my house and I went and I knew the art teacher knew a little bit about discus. So I went and I just said, hey, can you show me how to throw it? And so he actually became my coach and I started to learn how to throw discus. And it gave me this like sense of purpose, this like fresh energy in my life. And it just helped with everything else that I was doing. And I actually ended up placing like third in my city. And then I got to go on to like the next, because I loved it. I mean, it just was something to look forward to every day. And, in my laboratory, you know, if we kind of just fast forward to my lab, it's like, we're working in so many different areas right now. And to me, that's like doing new on a daily basis. And I just love learning about new things. And, you know, there's a certain vulnerability that you need to have, I think, to embrace new things. But once you experience that fresh energy and you feel like your brain being activated, like there's all sorts of neurotransmitters that are associated with like dopamine and endorphins and serotonin and oxytocin and, you know, all kinds of things. It's just, to me, it's just something that is a goal of mine on a daily basis. And now it kind of comes more naturally because I've just been doing it a lot. But it's something that anybody can engage, in their lives and just bring in that fresh energy on a daily mm-hmm. basis.
It kind of sounds like you have a natural bent toward this, but what if people are built a little bit differently and they're really intimidated by not knowing anything? How can we change that mindset?
So I think one way is, one of the processes I like to engage, is like a 4-step process. And I call it flip the switch, which is noticing your inner desire for possibility as the first step. So this could be in a relationship or it could be in like, you know, a hobby or a skill that you want to learn or the workplace or something with personal evolution, like just sort of being aware and open to the cues. You know, I feel like we're constantly getting cues from our minds. Our bodies are very intelligent. We're getting cues from the body and we're getting cues from other people that we're interacting with. And so I feel like this just sort of noticing this inner desire for possibility is the first step. And, you know, it takes time. It's just sort of like tuning into those cues. Sometimes we need to sort of slow down a bit, create a space in our schedule to be open to the cues. And by the way, this is one of the things I found that's so incredible about like technology and it, you know, let's say my relationship with technology, because I've been like, okay, I don't want to be on my cell phone as much. I don't want to do this as much, but that never works. Like if I just say, okay, I'm going to reduce it. But if I say I want to be open, my intention is to be open to the cues from my mind and my body. I can't get those cues if I'm on my phone. Right. Yeah. And so I need to put the phone away. So I found that by setting the intention of being available to these cues and noticing my inner desire for possibility, then I naturally am not going to go to my phone because I just have to sort of sit with it. And my thoughts are sort of, you know, maybe they're racing or maybe, you know, they're kind of sitting in one place or another, but I'm just starting to sort of get a feel for like, how are my emotions, my feelings, like, what am I excited about? Once you sort of notice that, the second step is to take stock of what's working and holding you back. And so it's kind of going through and saying, okay, maybe I'm doing a bunch of things in my day that I really like, but maybe there's this hobby I used to have when I was in high school or in, you know, and I haven't done it and I'd really like to get back into it, but I feel like just so busy and I don't know where it would fit in. But I really like sort of like figuring out what's working and what's holding you back. Like, oh, that hobby really brought energy to my life and I don't have it right now. And then the next thing is sort of thinking about other ways of thinking and other possibilities and sort of, you know, and this is, you know, and again, it's like bringing awareness and sort of engaging in a process. So it's the goal here is not necessarily to just do something new right away. It's really to find a process to engage that can just open your mind a little bit and to create a little space for you and to be able to then just take a small step forward. And so for me, that kind of step of noticing other possibilities, other ways of thinking, it's maybe like having conversations with other people like, oh, like, how did you, like, what were your hobbies when you were younger and how did you start getting back into them? Or you seem really passionate about this. How do you find time for that? And I feel once you start to kind of bring your awareness to these other possibilities, you start noticing people talking about them all the time. Right. It's like sort of like when you go outside and you walk somewhere every day and then finally you see something and you're like, it's been there the whole time, but you've never seen it because you just didn't have awareness to bring to it. And then the final step is just taking a deliberate step forward. And to me, that can be a small step. And so again, I just feel like there's a lot that we can do, but if we sort of look at things and this is kind of how I think about everything in life is like, if I'm not doing something right now that I want to do or that I'm not good at, it's because I'm not engaged in a process that works for me and I need to figure out that process. And so the focus becomes on the process and not the end goal. And every time I feel like I'm able to focus on the process, I make steps forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a more open-minded approach, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's kind of funny. I've told this story before, but recently I was walking. Actually, this is like a year or two ago, so not that recently. But I was walking in my neighborhood on the same path that I always walk, right? Like just making my same loop. And I was not paying attention. I think I must have just been looking up because I definitely wasn't looking down. Like, and I wasn't looking at my phone, but I was listening to something. And I heard a noise in front of me, and I looked up right before I almost like ran flat into a wild turkey that was right in the sidewalk. I was so close to just like walking into this thing. And those are huge and they're mean.
Yeah.
You do not want to kick a turkey.
We have some in my neighborhood. So yeah, I know. Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? I'm like not even aware of my surroundings. Mm-hmm. And I think that it can be so easy. It's like that habituation you were speaking about earlier, just to be in that kind of loop and to not hop out and be like, oh, actually, what's happening around me?
Yeah. So I've had the exact same experience. And one of the things that I've done to try to evolve, let's say, is as I'm walking outside, I've been experimenting with cycling through my senses. So let's say I have two dogs that are actually sitting beside me right now. Well, one's here and one's back there. But when I walk them, I'll say like, okay, sight. And I'll try to just focus on looking at like the texture of the bark on the trees or the color of the leaves. And then I'll say sound, and I'll just, you know, kind of try to focus on my sense of sound and listen for the birds or sort of like the rustling of the leaves or the wind through the, and then I'll say touch, and I'll feel like the wind against my face or like my feet kind of hitting the ground. And usually I'm sort of slow walking at this point because I'm really trying to tune in. And, you know, you could say taste. I mean, you know, if there's something left from breakfast in your mouth or something like that, or smell, you know, sometimes there's a smell in the neighborhood. But I find through doing this, it really helps me to get out of my head and mm-hmm. to get more into connecting with my senses. And I feel this set when I do that, there's this sense of calm, this sort of reduced anxiety, this just sense of wellness. When I can bring my focus to my like senses versus just be sort of in this, state of my mind, just rumination and, you know, kind of thinking of what just happened or what's going to happen next, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's just this sense of presence and awareness that can be difficult, especially if you're just like always, you know, fast walking everywhere, which many of us do.
Oh, I accelerate. I notice that. So that's one of the things that, you know, another tool that I go, it's kind of like a key go-to tool. I like to think of it as press pause. And it's really about, you know, how I found I just need time to process experiences, process knowledge that I've just learned, to slow down. And when I do that, when I make that an intention, like if I'm walking, I start to bring awareness to it. And I realize like, wait a moment, I'm accelerating. Like every time I sort of, you know, stop, look at something, it's like I accelerate forward. And so kind of getting in touch with that and slowing down has just, it's just expanded my mind in so many ways. Like even just sort of when I look at the birds and I'm sort of interested in seeing how they're communicating with each other and seeing how, you know, the squirrels, like what are the patterns? Like there's so many patterns to sort of recognize when you're out in nature, of how different birds kind of interact with each other. And, like this morning I was, we have this, pond not too far from my house. And I drop my daughter off at school. I take our two dogs through the woods, and then I sit down and I have my breakfast, and I like to now sit on this rock and just be at the pond. And there were like these two swans that were there, and, these two ducks kind of swimming towards me. And, you know, I was just like, I was just so peaceful, but yet I'm also sort of curious about what they're doing and like, you know, like how their relationship's going. And, you know, there's just so many things to think about, right? When you start to go outside and connect with that and really get in touch, I think, with the nuances of life.
Yeah. It's so intentional, which takes a lot of energy and also creativity. And I think that's something that I've been thinking about a lot as we've been talking. And I think there are a lot of people that I've met anyway who just feel like they're not creative. And I wonder how you navigate that, especially in talking about this in your book about harnessing creativity and energy to improve our wellness overall.
Yeah. I think there's sort of like this general belief that people like, you know, they're either creative or they're not creative, or you can't really get better at being creative, or there's certain activities that are creative and others that aren't. And what I found, actually, maybe I'll go back to my first year in grad school, because this, I feel like, really unlocked my creativity, what I'm about to say. And that is that, so I get to grad school and I go to these seminars, and, you know, I'm barely able to pay attention, you know, kind of not really sure what's going on, just a little bit here or there. I get to the question time at the end of the seminars, like for invited speakers. And it's like, people like someone over here are like, you know, 3 o'clock sweater vest asks this incredible question, just cuts to the heart of the whole presentation. And I was like, oh my God, this is such an important question. Why didn't I think of that? You know, what's wrong with me? Like, you know, start like shaming myself. And then, you know, someone over here on my left asked like this amazing question. And I'm just like, again, why is that? Why am I not thinking of these questions? And here I was, you know, having worked on developing tools, and questions have been such an important part of my life, but yet these questions were not coming to me. And so I knew by that point that like, I was like, okay, there must be other possibilities here. Like, I noticed my inner desire for possibility to get better at asking questions. But I really didn't know what to do. And so I just sort of sat with it for a while. And then I was like, I started to think, like, I used to play chess with my dad a little bit. And I think, you know, what separates like an amateur chess player from a master chess player is pattern recognition, being able to think, you know, like 10 moves ahead or, you know, whatever, 12 moves or whatever it is. And I started thinking like, okay, maybe I could bring pattern recognition to this. What if I go to seminars and write down all the questions that people ask? And so I literally did that for like, you know, a couple months. And then I stopped and I looked through, and all of a sudden I noticed that all the questions that people were asking at the end of seminars, that there was like five categories, sort of just that I could put these questions under, you know, like related to like, can we trust the data? You know, did the experiment run properly? Are the results important? Did they run the right statistics? Did they overstate their conclusions? Like, there were a bunch of like categories. So then when I went to the next seminar, it's like I had my detective hat on. Now I was paying like detailed attention to everything they were saying, because I'm looking for holes in what they're saying, because I want to ask one of these important questions at the end. And what happened was, is that like all of a sudden, so I'm now paying more attention. I'm imprinting the knowledge more into my mind. I'm learning more, but I'm also starting to recognize that I'm connecting dots from what I know before to what they're saying. And I start coming up with ideas for what they could potentially try next. So by getting better at asking questions and finding a way to focus my attention through questions, I was not only sort of stoking my curiosity and activating my brain, but I was like infusing creativity into my mind, into my life. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I feel like anybody can do it. Anybody can get better at asking questions. And you can even bring this to social settings, like, you know, and connect more with people, because when you start to become curious about somebody, that's when I think the real deep connections kind of open up. And so I think, you know, and I've done this too, is just sort of in social like networking events or whatever it is, sort of, there's always a few people who are really great at socializing. And so I listen to what questions they're asking. And then I start to think about asking those types of questions to then connect with others. And, you know, then it's like when you form that connection, and then when you listen to the answer, you deepen the connection.
Yeah. I like that you use that kind of as an invitation to learn how to solve this puzzle versus over-identifying with, oh, I'm just not good at asking questions. Like, mm-hmm. It became a puzzle to solve.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like, I realized, like, I used to have that mindset, and I feel like I've been able to rewire it over time. And that's another thing. Like, I think, like, we have, like, our neuroplasticity, our ability to reprogram our brain, to rewire our brain, to strengthen connections, prune away old connections. It's like our evolutionary inheritance. It's like everybody has that capability. Like, no one can take that away from you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, nobody can take your senses away from you. Like, you always have that. And so what I found is that when I am more intentional with things in my thinking, in my actions, then I develop these new patterns. I develop new habits. And so I can now like shame myself much less than when I used to, because instead of saying like, oh, I'm bad at that, I just think, okay, I probably just haven't engaged a process yet that works for me. And I just need to find it.
I appreciate that, like the yet portion of that a lot. Mm-hmm. What strategies or advice can you offer to people who are really struggling to, you know, shake up their routines, or maybe they're feeling stuck and they want to create more positive change in their world?
So I'm a big believer that, you know, most things that we do have a domino effect throughout our lives and in the lives of other people. And so I think that, you know, sometimes with our busy lives and, you know, back to back, you know, whatever we're doing, I think that there's like literally tiny little changes that we can make in our life that will start to, build our confidence to then and create momentum for us to take bigger steps. So it's really about just trying to find those tiny little things. And this may sound silly, but some things that I've done before is like brush my teeth with the other hand, you know, because it kind of shakes up your brain and it feels really weird at first. And you're kind of like, I'm not good at this. And it takes me mm-hmm. twice as long. So why would I do it? But I find when I start doing it, and then if I stay with it for a few days or a week or whatever it is, then I start getting better at it. And it's like I'm literally rewiring my brain in the process. Mm-hmm. And I think once you start doing that, your brain wants more of it. And then it's easier to change other things in your life as well. So there are, like, you could just change the route that you drive to work, or you could change the path you take when you walk around your neighborhood. Or so just making these small changes in our lives, I think, like, it activates our brains, it starts to rewire them, and it opens the door to make it easier to make other changes in our lives. And so I think that's kind of what one of the things that we can do.
Yeah. It's like something simple, but also something that has a little bit of an injection of fun or joy or curiosity or gamification. Like, that seems to be a really helpful aspect of that.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like there's this, you know, practicing something can get boring at times. And I feel like if we can find ways to infuse joy in our practices, and I think part of that is being open to the cues. Like, let's say if you start brushing your teeth with the other hand, it's not going to be a fun experience the first time, but like two or three times later, you might be like, wait a moment, I'm kind of getting a bit better at this. And that feels, there's like this incremental good feeling about that, you know? And so tuning into that for making these changes, I think can also be really, really helpful. So looking for, like sort of tuning into when our brains get excited and feeling that fresh energy being infused in. And, you know, we can also change, like, you know, the way that, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, why am I using this tone of voice with this person every time? Or why do I interrupt them? Or why am I not holding space for them? I feel like so we can make changes like that, like before going into conversations with people. Let's say if I'm meeting with people in my lab, I now have this ritual where I'll say, this person is the most important person in their life, right? And so if I say that before I go into the conversation, it sort of sets the tone in my mind that then creates this reference point or this sort of, you know, this grounding for the whole conversation. And so these are the tiny things that we can do that can just start to create, you know, get the ball rolling and create this domino effect for more change in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot. I was just reading this book this week about feel good productivity. It's by Ali Abdaal, who is one of my favorite YouTubers. And he wrote this book and he talks about being sincere, but not serious, approaching things with sincerity, but not being too serious about it, like having that lightness, which I really appreciate. And I think that's reflected in what you're just sharing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's the other thing too, is that, like, just as an example, this morning, here I am sitting, eating my breakfast, and these two ducks kind of fly down and the part of the pond had frozen over and they landed right in front of me, but they just slid because they landed on the ice, you know? And I was just like, kind of like noticing that and sort of realizing like, that's a pretty funny thing, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know, just, I thought it was ridiculous, right? That they like landed and they just kind of slid, you know? Like, it's like, And I just feel like there's these nuanced things happening all around us. And if we just bring our awareness, our attention to it, we start to realize that, that there's just so many things out there that can stoke our curiosity, but also make us smile, make us laugh. You know, they're all right there. And I'll give you another example, and maybe this is a little too far out there, but, you know, actually there's a couple examples, but one is, if I look outside, right, and I see like a tree blowing in the wind, this happened to me recently. I was thinking to myself, okay, I could think of this as just the wind is hitting the tree and it's blowing back and forth. But I could also think of this as like the tree is waving at me, you know, like the tree is waving at me and that will make me feel good, right? Like, wow, I'm like connecting with the tree, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, I just feel there's so many things like that. A friend of mine, Bridge, he said to me recently, kind of connected to this, he goes, you know, if somebody built a bird, like actually made a bird, he said, and then showed it to people, people would be like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. But yet here we see a bird and we're just like, hey, that's a bird, you know? And it's that sense of like, how do we, it's like just by naming things, I feel like it, just this kind of human nature to put things in boxes, and to have just nomenclature for everything, it really takes away from the connection that we can have with it. And so I've been also trying to do that as a practice to kind of, when I see birds, I'm not like, oh, that's a bird. I'm more like, just like, wow, like, how does it fly? And look at that, like, you know, how is this possible? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, look at the pattern of the flight. And, you know, just trying to kind of tune into these types of things, I feel it also just brings a lot of joy to my life and gratitude as well.
Yeah. And having that interaction with nature too is required, because you can't really observe it. I mean, you could watch it on YouTube, but like, I had a dove fly into my house recently. And I was like, oh my gosh, it was like a little stressful actually, but it landed on a picture frame. And I was amazed that this picture frame didn't budge. It's because the dove was so light. And I am still thinking about that. Like, I'm like, oh yeah. Wow, that's so crazy. Like how light that animal is. It looks really plump, you know, but right, it's actually weighs probably like practically nothing. And, you know, it just made me think about all these different things about how doves are and birds are. And, but it's that up close interaction in some sense that allowed that concept.
Yeah. There's a number of books that have been written recently about awe and how it literally is just like all around us. And it's almost like we've been habituated by our culture or other things to not sort of make it a priority to embrace. But when you start to develop an awareness, that is something you can access on a daily basis, you know, all the time, it really does bring a sense of wellness to our life and, you know, stokes our curiosity, activates our brain, all sorts of positive neurotransmitters. It's just really good for us to experience awe, you know, like looking up at the night sky and seeing the sea of or ocean of stars, or, you know, just, you know, thinking about how trees like are able to bend towards the light. I'm getting involved in actually some initiatives in Panama, and I've been to the jungle there, and there's a tree, there's like a tree that literally walks, like it has these, parts of it, you know, parts that kind of go out to the sides. And then what happens is it walks towards the light because the parts in the middle that anchor into the ground like die, and then it creates like a new sort of like root system, and it just allows itself to pull itself through, because in the jungle there's just so much vegetation there that it's just this massive competition for light. And so now there's a tree that's evolved to be able to walk towards the light. And wow. You know, these things are just unbelievable.
That's incredible. Wow. Yeah. Nature is so cool. Learning more.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many example after example of, you know, and then even just like thinking about, I mean, it's an example people talk about a lot, but just like caterpillar going to a butterfly. I mean, it's just unbelievable to think about, like, how does that happen? And I feel like, you know, maybe we've heard that a number of times, but there's just so much there. And I think the onus is kind of on us to sort of take away that nomenclature of like, oh, that's just a butterfly, or that's just a caterpillar, or we've talked about that so much, why can't we move on to something else? But like, there's just so much to embrace in that and be curious about and be just awestruck by what's happening all around us in our backyards.
Yeah. I'm really excited for myself actually to get my hands on your book, but also for our listeners too, because just thinking about these ideas is so helpful to be like, oh, I could just like look out my window today and encounter something new or think about something differently just by observing nature. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book and learning more about that. And I'm wondering if you can share where people can find you and your work and your book.
Absolutely. So I'm just in the process of putting a website together. My name is the easiest one to get to is Jeff Karp, Karp with a K, .com. We'll have, I'm going to have on the site, information about the book and my laboratory, some of the projects that we're working on, the bio-inspired work. And also I'm going to have a part on the site for my mom to post her poems. So she's been writing poems. She's written like 300 poems in the last year or two. And so I like to call her in the morning and have her read me like a couple of her poems. And so, you know, just, she's just been so supportive. It's kind of like the least that I can do, like, and she's really excited about it. So you'll be able to go to the site and read my mom's poems.
Oh my gosh. I feel like your mom is going to become an internet sensation.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay. So I have two last questions that I ask everyone. Okay. First off is, tell me about a book that has helped you, inspired you, or shaped you in the last year.
Wow. So I would say, there's a book called Into the Magic Shop by James Doty, who's a neurosurgeon at Stanford. And it was a book that it's just such an incredible story. It talks about his struggles early on in his life, like through his childhood, and how he went into this magic shop because he was interested in magic. And the person like who runs the shop wasn't there, but the mother was. And she was basically like, I'm going to show you what real magic is. And it was all about compassion and how to learn to be compassionate towards yourself mm-hmm. and others. So it was just this unbelievable story. And I have a hard time reading. So I listen to it, but actually I've gotten better at reading so I can focus my attention more, but I listened to it and I just loved it. It was amazing.
Okay. I'm going to go on my library app as soon as we hang up and find that because that sounds excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question. What is a piece of advice that has really stuck with you?
So, when I was doing my postdoctoral fellowship at MIT, with Bob Langer, who's this unbelievable mentor on every level. I mean, he's actually co-founder of Moderna and a number of other companies, and he's just such a good person. And he has given me so much advice, but one of the things that really stands out is he said, you never want to limit anybody. And it's something that I have really thought a lot about, like as a mentor, you know, running a research lab with a bunch of people and just kind of thinking like, there's so many things that bring energy to people's lives, like extracurricular activities or hobbies or things like that. So sort of seeing people's lives as being very holistic, that it's just not about what they're working on at that moment. It's really these other components of their life are so important to elevate everything. Like they're going to do their best research and their best work if they're constantly evolving and trying new things and getting involved in activities and also working on other projects, like collaborating with other people, not just having one project, but, you know, sort of letting them be empowered to use their curiosity to explore things that maybe aren't related to what we have our grant funding for, things like that. So yeah, never limit anybody. That jumps to mind is something that's really been important in my life.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it also kind of reminds me of your story overall, where in second grade, you were almost held back. And then, you know, now you work at Harvard, you did your postdoctoral at MIT, and like these illustrious institutions that as a second grader, you know, I don't think that your teachers would have expected that from you.
Yeah, they asked me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said a doctor. And they said, well, you better set your sights lower because you don't have it in you. To do that, that was one of the things, that happened. Actually, what ended up happening is I did apply to medical school and I didn't get in. So that was one of the big kind of challenges that I faced at one point. So maybe they're right about that. But my career kind of took a different trajectory. I became very excited about problem solving and mm-hmm. just this process of medical problem solving. And I've just found it, you know, just so exciting. And every day is there's just so much fresh energy. There's so many problems that are just so important for us to help patients, with, and that's what I've really dedicated my career to.
Yeah. And it's life-changing for people.
It is life-changing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've had a number of technologies that, you know, are in clinical trials now, a bunch that have actually made it to, you know, to patients. And so it's just super rewarding to see people benefit from the technologies that we've been, you know, working so hard to develop in the lab.
Yeah. Okay. I think we could talk for another hour about all of these projects that you've developed, but I think we should wind it down here. So thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great conversation and I've learned so much and I'm excited now to go on my next nature walk.
Yeah. Well, it's so nice to speak with you. I really enjoyed this as well. And thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks so much for listening to Enneagram IRL. If you loved the show, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and review. This is the easiest way to make sure new people find the show, and it's so helpful for a new podcast like this one. If you want to stay connected, sign up for my email list in the show notes or message me on Instagram at 9typesco to tell me your one big takeaway from today's show. I'd love to hear from you. I know there are a million podcasts you could have been listening to, and I feel so grateful that you chose to spend this time with me. Can't wait to meet you right back here for another episode of Enneagram IRL very soon. The Enneagram in Real Life podcast is a production of 9types Co. LLC. It's created and produced by Stephanie Baron Hall, with editing support from Brandon Hall, and additional support from Crits Collaborations. Thanks to Dr. Dreamchip for our amazing theme song, and you can also check out all of their music on Spotify.